Now, St. Paul said that if Jesus has not been raised from the dead, then our faith is in vain. It's empty. It has no teeth. The resurrection accounts that we read in the scriptures are so important for us. And we can kind of notice when we read them that they were intentionally trying to address the different doubts and misconceptions, skepticism and rebuttals that the early Christians would have faced in the first century when they said, for the first time in the history of the world, somebody came back from the dead, somebody rose from the dead. Some of these doubts were, oh, well, the women just went to the wrong tomb. They didn't know where they were going. So they found an empty tomb because nobody had ever been put in that tomb. Or that the grave had been robbed. Or even that Jesus' disciples himself had taken his body. One of the other doubts or misconceptions is that, oh, these people who claim to see Jesus saw simply a ghost, some spiritual manifestation, not Jesus himself in his body. So it's one thing to take all of these doubts or misconceptions, skepticism, and say, well, you're wrong. It's quite another thing when you say, well, yeah, actually, we thought the same thing at first, until this happened. And pretty much in every case, that's what we see in the resurrection accounts. Like, yeah, that's what we thought. But it turned out that something else had happened. Here, the apostles, the disciples of Jesus, as he appears in their midst, they're startled and terrified. They think that they're seeing a ghost. And I think being startled and terrified is probably the natural reaction if you think that you've seen a ghost. Okay? But Jesus knows, of course, he knows their hearts. And so he addresses this directly. And he says, look at my hands and my feet. Touch me and see. But I'm not a ghost. I have a body. Ghosts don't have bodies. And by the way, give me something to eat. Okay. All these ways to prove that he was bodily present in their midst. So the resurrection accounts help those who listen, who might be a little bit skeptical, to realize that even the disciples themselves had that same skepticism, those same doubts, those same questions, but they were all addressed. They were all overcome by these experiences with the risen Lord. What forms of evidence do we have of the resurrection of Jesus? Because if Jesus is not truly raised, our faith is empty. It's in vain. Now we have the circumstantial evidence, which is the empty tomb, the linens rolled up, and so on. And Jesus' prophecies that this is what was going to happen, that the Messiah must suffer and die and so enter into his glory. That if you destroy this temple, in 3 days I will raise it up. Jesus spoke about these things. We call that perhaps circumstantial evidence. In Luke's Gospel, in the resurrection accounts, there's a particular emphasis on the attestation from the Old Testament. All of the prophecies that point to this reality that Jesus himself had announced. And so, as Jesus in disguise is walking with the disciples on the road to Emmaus, he opens the scriptures to them and explains it. Here once again, in our gospel passage today, he stops and says, don't you understand, don't you remember all that the scriptures have said and how it points to this? Another form of evidence that strengthened the faith of the early church. Above all, it's the fact that the apostles were eyewitnesses to these things. And Jesus emphasizes this. You are witnesses to these things. And what does a witness have to do? Testify to what has been seen. In addition to that, another great form of evidence that inspired so many to faith in the early church was the mighty deeds that were done at the hands of Christians. I want to take this little aside in the middle of my homily to extend an invitation to our parish mission, which is going to be next week. It's part of the Eucharistic revival for us. So we have a speaker coming in who will be unpacking various miracles, the evidence that supports them, and what they mean for us and how it fits in with our Catholic faith. So Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, we have three presentations. The same presentation three times. So just choose one of those dates that works well for you. Love to have you be there to help shore up our faith by bringing more evidence to that which we believe. In the end, however, isn't there a mystery to the way that God works and elicits faith? Why are we here and somebody else that we grew up with, our neighbor, is not here or is not a believer? Why does God choose these methods, these forms of evidence, rather than simply manifesting the truth to all minds at one time completely? He's all powerful. He could do that, couldn't he? For that matter, why does the revelation of Jesus happen in the way it does? Why does Jesus submit to baptism in a dirty river on the border between civilization and the wilderness? Why does he choose to have his first miracle in a tiny town at a family affair, at a wedding, to change water into wine? Why does he perform most of his miracles in a backwater region of Galilee, where most of the people would think, oh, well, they're uneducated, they don't know what they're talking about anyway? Why would he request that his miracles be kept a secret? Why would the transfiguration, the moment when his glory is revealed or opened up, be witnessed to by only three people? Why would he only invite three to see that reality? Why does Jesus silent through his trial and his crucifixion, rather than choosing that moment to display that he has power over those earthly powers who are putting him to death? Why does in his resurrection he only appear to his disciples, a select few, rather than manifesting himself to everyone, especially those who have put him to death or who have disbelieved him? Why? It seems like not the most effective way. And the skeptic would hear all these things and say, well, that's very troubling for your argument that Jesus is who he says he is. It's just his cronies who are standing up for him. You know, when we, for example, develop a new drug, right, we want to have blind testing, we want to have unbiased scientists studying it, we want to intentionally try to find proof that the drug isn't effective or that it's harmful. It's not just the very people who are involved in developing it who give a stamp of approval and promote it. The skeptic would be more skeptical after hearing this mysterious way why Jesus reveals himself only to these select few. So Pope Benedict XVI wrote this. He said all of us are constantly inclined to ask the question that one of the apostles asked at the Last Supper: Lord, why is it that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world? Why indeed did you not forcefully resist your enemies who brought you to the cross, we might well ask? Why did you not show them with incontrovertible power that you are the living one, the Lord of life and death? Why did you reveal yourself only to a small flock of disciples upon whose testimony we must now rely? The question applies not only to the resurrection, but to the whole manner of God's revelation in the world. It is part of the mystery of God, Pope Benedict said, that he acts so gently, that he only gradually builds up his history within the great history of mankind, that he becomes man and so can be overlooked by his contemporaries and by the decisive forces within history, that he suffers and dies, and that having risen again, he chooses to come to mankind only through the faith of the disciples to whom he reveals himself, that he continues to knock gently at the doors of our hearts and slowly opens our eyes if we open our doors to him. And yet, is not this the truly divine way? Not to overwhelm with external power, but to give freedom, to offer and elicit love. You see what he's saying? I think a lot of us have this thought, this wonder, like, Lord, why don't you just make it clear to me? Why don't you just overpower me with your grace and make it impossible for me to doubt? Or Lord, if you are who you say you are, why don't you just resolve all of my problems, remove all of my temptations? Lord, why do you permit suffering in my life and in the life of those that I love, if I know that you have the power to take it away? And the answer, it seems, Pope Benedict is saying, is that because if that were the way God operated, there would be no merit in your choice of him. If that were the way that God chose to act, there would be no freedom in your act of faith. And he says, if that were the way that I worked, there would be no love in your response to my gift. And this is what God truly wants, to offer love and to freely elicit our response of love. God acts in this mysterious way, planting the seed of faith, the smallest of seeds, in the hearts of very few, the apostles to whom he reveals himself, so that he's not overwhelming, overpowering mankind, removing our freedom or our capacity to choose him, but that always, no matter where we are in history, no matter what happens, we will need to act in faith, to make a choice to believe in him, to believe in his love for us. At the end of John's Gospel, before the epilogue, we heard it last week, John said, "These things are written that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that through this belief you may have life in his name." These testimonies aren't written to overpower our intellect, but to open a door for us so that we can choose whether to walk through or not, whether to have faith or not, whether to believe or walk away. If we choose in faith to believe, we will find life in his name, just as these apostles did, just as these first witnesses did, who courageously went to the ends of the earth to give testimony to what they have seen. The Lord provides this evidence, but not overwhelmingly, not in a way that takes away our freedom, because all he wants is for us to freely choose him to elicit our love.